being loud about what you love is just climbing to the top of your mountain and saying, I really want to get into that conference. Or, hey guys, I'm going to start posting online because I really love, I don't know, I love cooking and I want to show you my recipes, you know, whatever that is. But being loud about what you love lets you meet other people who love what you love or are intrigued by what you love. And it's everything in the world to me.
Welcome to the Technical Difficulties Podcast. I'm Liz Gerber, and a design professor at Northwestern.
And I'm Lauren Lin, and I'm a student who has also worked in the design industry. Each week, we speak with women leaders in design and technology. And today, we are so excited to welcome Malvika Bhatt. You might know her as a host on her podcast, Show Me How Good It Gets, and a content creator on TikTok with over 100,000 followers. Malvika is most excited about understanding how we exist on and with the internet, which we can't wait to dig into. When not influencing online, she's working on her doctoral degree in computer science and communication at Northwestern University. Go Cats. And we are thrilled to have her here and give some big sister advice and real talk about grad school, early careers, as well as her reflections on media tech and design. So we can't wait to hear from Malvika. Thank you, Malvika, for joining us today.
Thank you guys for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
So we like to start off with some fun questions. No wrong answers. And our question is, what's your favorite way to start your morning?
My favorite way to start my morning, the way I actually start my morning is probably checking my phone, which I hate about myself. But my favorite way to start it is checking my calendar and seeing what I have to do that day and making a rough to-do list. I always get really stressed if I think I have a lot to do and I don't know where it is in my day versus if I actually just jot it down, I feel more in control. And then I'll do like a quick journal, like a 2 or 3 minute journal. I feel very prepped with that. Yeah.
Good for you. And thank you for distinguishing between how you do start and how you wish you started. I can relate to that. Yeah. Another question is, what's your favorite creativity tool, broadly defined?
Oh, this is such a fun one. I was actually prepped for this because I listened to all your previous episodes. But I would say my favorite creativity tool is a blank journal and a pen I really like writing with.
And we have to ask, what's the pen?
I use a Micron. I get it at Blick Art Materials, and it's like a little thick, and it doesn't bleed through the page, which is important to me.
I love asking that question because people who have favorite pens know their favorite pens.
Yes.
Okay, Lauren's going to dive into some career questions now.
Yeah, so we want to start out with, like, how did you get started in technology design? Specifically, what was your, like, I'm a designer moment or I should be in tech moment? Was it a moment or was it mostly now, like, in retrospect?
Totally. I think this is a fantastic question because for a long time I felt so insecure about not having a specific moment or this, like, light bulb as a kid. I remember I felt so jealous of people who had always known what they wanted to be. You know, my mom was like that. I have friends who, when they were 6 years old, were like, I'm going to be a doctor. And now they're in med school. I didn't really have anything like that. I was interested in a lot of things. I didn't really have a passion for a long time. And in high school, I had a math teacher who was just such a good mentor. And I really liked math. And she said, have you ever thought about engineering? And I said, I don't even know what that is because it's this very nebulous thing. And she said, I think you'd like it. You should look into that. And I found a school that specialized in just engineering called Olin College out in Needham, Massachusetts. And I loved what they were doing with engineering pedagogy. They have a liberal arts approach to tech. And I thought what they were doing was so different and intrigued me. So I visited once, fell in love with the campus and the educators there, and decided that's where I was going to go. And even when I was there the first couple years, everyone had done robotics their whole life and kind of knew it was where they were meant to be. So I didn't really feel like I belonged as a designer or in tech for a long time there. And then I took a class called User-Oriented Collaborative Design while I was there, taught by Professor Sarah Hendren, who is fabulous and I have nothing but good things to say about her. And the goal of that class is to teach you participatory design. So you're assigned a user group and you have to go speak to them, do interviews with them, and then design some sort of product or service for them. And I got the user group of zookeepers and ended up designing a fur seal enclosure for the aquarium nearby. And I just loved that project, and it gave me so much validation that I was in the right place, doing the right thing around people who inspired me. And around that time, I started to figure out what I wanted to do in grad school. So it was just kind of, I like to think of life as less linear and more modular. So I guess I didn't have one aha moment, but I had all these little experiences that made me feel, okay, maybe I am totally doing the right thing and in the right place. And I've just been really lucky with amazing mentors who keep giving me a thumbs up and a green flag. So,
okay. So I love that story, and I love your description of this as modular. You are, you don't just have one career, you have many. Another career that you're also pursuing is one of a TikTok creator and a social influencer online. So tell us a little bit about how you got started in that.
Yeah, it's so interesting you say that. I feel like I had a lot of shame with this word influencer for a while because I was afraid I wouldn't be taken as seriously in the academic world if people kind of found this thing out about me. But I really started posting because, you know, after you read something, you're like, oh, I just need to talk about this with someone. It was kind of that. I'd started reading a lot of books during the pandemic, as I think a lot of people did. And one day I just decided to post a video saying, hey, I just read this book and I need to talk about it with someone. Someone else has got to read it. And I went to bed thinking it would get like 500 views, and I woke up and it had 1 million. And something kind of unlocked for me, like, oh, people care about my thoughts on what I'm reading and how it impacts me. And that was just a really crazy feeling, right? Because TikTok can really democratize knowledge in a very unique way. And I realized that my thoughts had value. And that sounds so silly to say, but as a 20-year-old girl, you often don't think that. So.
And how have your thoughts about whether you're being taken seriously or not as a social influencer and an academic developed?
I think, and I hate that this is thing, but I think it's developed because of validation. I think having people reach out to me and say, hey, this is really cool that you're doing this, can I know more about it, has really helped, because it's made me feel like, oh, there is, you know, a value in this. And the fact that I'm reaching 100,000 people and talking to them about things I'm passionate about. I think the very specific unlock for me was I read this book called Burn the Boats by Matt Higgins. He's an entrepreneur, a founder. He's been a guest shark on Shark Tank. And I just DM'd him on Instagram after I read his book off the cuff saying, you know, I really loved this book. And he responded, and we set up an interview for my podcast with him. And after the interview, I told him, I was like, you know what, I thank you for giving me this opportunity. I totally don't have, you know, like a production team or the setup for this. And he said, no, I think you did a really amazing job. And he wanted to pick my brain about what it means to be a creator and how he can leverage the TikTok platform. And having someone I look up to and respect so much kind of ask for my advice or my opinion was like, oh, what I'm doing is cool and interesting to people. That's crazy. You know, that's kind of the feeling I got. And since then, I've tried to be less ashamed about it and more think of it as like this interesting platform that, you know, a lot of people don't know about and does have a lot of value.
I have to probe a little deeper. Thank you. But you started this with saying, I hate to say, but I needed the validation. What, can you dive a little deeper into that? What, why are you resistant to needing and liking validation?
Yeah, I think this is so interesting. And I would actually love to hear your opinion on this as well. But there is so much of a push to give yourself that validation or know what you're doing is good or valuable. But I think it's pretty hard to have that inner compass fully developed from a young age, right? I have, you know, people I really trust, and I have a moral compass, and I have values, and I have my own sense of ethics. But there is something about someone you respect telling you, hey, I think you're doing a good job. And I think what you're doing is doing good in the world. And I've always found that to be a really helpful, like, hey, keep going sort of thing. And there's one thing when it's your parents and your friends telling you that, and there's a very different feeling when it's a mentor or a professor or someone that you look up to and put on a pedestal. And I don't know, how do you think about that? What's your relationship with external validation?
That's why I pushed you on it a bit. Is that kind of mixed feelings about it? Like you said, on the one hand, I know it is inspires me, and especially, as you said, the farther out it is from somebody that I know personally. And on the other hand, I wish my internal voice was louder. And I keep thinking someday it's just going to be really loud and I'm not going to even pay attention to the external world. And I've realized while it's strengthened, I still, I'm somebody that likes being engaged with the world, and I like hearing what people think, and I'm not going to go off and just create with no reaction. That's not why I create. It's I want to. Part of my reason for being is to evoke reaction, and so I am trying to get more comfortable myself with being comfortable with knowing that I like to hear people's reactions.
This is like interesting, because knowing like someone who is older and that like we respect is also wishing that their internal voice was louder. And being a younger student, you're like, well, with time, as I grow older, this will just like develop, or one day it'll just come and you'll feel more confident. But kind of knowing it's a journey like all throughout, that is sort of like comforting to know.
I hear people I look up to that still say they enjoy hearing external validation. I think it's why you hear it and what you need it to use it for that I'm trying to tease out a bit. I'm still going to do the things I'm going to do, but it's a signal that I am having an impact on other people, which I appreciate. And so I have a different relationship with it that I did maybe when I was younger, but I still value it and appreciate it. It's never, what I realized for me is it's never going to go away. And that's okay. I'm okay with that.
And then how do you sift through judgment versus maybe constructive criticism? If if you really do rely on the voices, how do you sift through them?
Oh, well, first there's the emotional reaction, right? It's just, oh my gosh, what's happening? And I just have to take that in. And then there's a separation, and then looking at it later constructively and really trying to look at everything as a learning opportunity. What can I learn through that critique? What can I learn through that compliment? Everybody's coming in with a biased point of view, so I'm not going to take anything at face value, but what's the learning that I can have both in the content that they're sharing, but also in my reaction to it? So I think being more even-handed about it, but I can never, I'm not in the moment, I am not good at it. I struggle, I think like everybody else in the moment, to take either great praise or great critique in the moment.
Yeah, I also, that reminds me, I feel like self-awareness is a very good quality, and like to be aware, you need to be reading signals from other people, and some of that is like validation, but I don't know, like how do you be aware and also not let some of like the noise get to you? So that was a really interesting thread, Malvika, that we went down. I don't know if you have any more thoughts on that, but I appreciated that too, just like as a young student.
Yeah, that was so helpful for me to know that I keep expecting one day to wake up every birthday. I'm like, okay, now I'm going to have this like really strong inner voice. Like it's going to happen this year. So it is helpful to know that it's always going to be this like, not a battle, but this ongoing evolution of, you know, figuring that out. But it's what it is, right?
Yes. Okay. So speaking of reactions and thinking about TikTok, but also grad school, I'm wondering if there were any interesting intersections, like in posting, it influenced how you think about social technologies. And also, like, you are in your dual PhD in technology and social behavior. So are there any like unexpected synergies between those, or do they kind of inspire each other? Because I feel like that's a really cool combination.
Yes, this is a great question. And this happens to me all the time. Maybe once or twice a week, I'm reading a paper on online communities, and then I go and post to my online community, right? So very often it is pretty meta. And some things, when I first started posting, I realized that the videos that tend to do better or garner a larger viewership were videos where I presented something and erased some nuance from it. You know, if I go online and I say I have this one hack that takes no work and you'll figure out what your passion is, or you'll find your dream career, if I go on there and say that, that video is getting a million views, versus if I go on there and I say, you know, you're going to do these 20 things over the course of 8 months and it's going to be really hard, that video is getting like 1,000 views because there's more nuance in that take. And life is really nuanced and problems are really nuanced. And I was seeing myself kind of in my own brain flatten things so I could present them in a way that was easier, that was quicker, that kind of, I don't like to use the word clickbait here, but is a little more sensationalist, let's say. And I was realizing those views did better, and this is a tired conversation, everyone knows that, but I had to kind of work backwards and tell myself that I actually don't want my brain to start working that way, just because I'm posting in a way. So that's when I started my own podcast, because I really missed long-form content and conversation and pulling things apart over time. And that was something that I now read about all the time, right? How the younger generations are interpreting media and how media literacy is changing with the generations. I think a lot about how attention spans are changing, how we're designing our tech in really different ways. And I feel like I have this body of user researchers constantly at my disposal and at my fingertips, which is, you know, both a really cool thing and a responsibility. So I try to use that wisely.
I have another question about grad school, if I could jump in. Because I have some friends who are also like, well, like, is grad school an option for me? Like a PhD in theory sounds really cool. And I know you've talked about how this program is like your dream program and you're really happy to have discovered it. So how did you discover it and realize it was the right program for you?
Totally. Feel free to jump in at any point, because I feel like this is a little bit of a long story. But again, I don't think I always knew I wanted to get a PhD. And a lot of my peers now have always been like, I'm going to be in academia and I know my 1, 2, 3 to become, you know, a professor at this R1 institution. And again, I'm not like that. And in my undergrad, I actually thought I was going to go into industry for the longest time. All my friends were. I was at an amazing undergrad engineering institution, which really pushed going out and getting internships. So I was interning at places like NASA JPL, and I really liked my work. But I really was craving a more long-form project, not something just for the summer or for a few months. I really wanted to delve in and look at it from every angle and really dissect it. But I didn't think of a PhD at all. And everyone is telling me, like, find your passion, you know, find your passion and make that your profession. That's like the number one piece of advice you get. And I'm thinking, like, whoa, 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 America does a lot of intertwining of passion and profession. That's not very helpful, right? When you're 20 years old and you're trying to figure out what your first job out of college should be, it's not helpful for people to be like, you have to love it. You have to love what you do and you won't work a day in your life. I mean, everyone has heard the saying, and it's kind of a terrifying thing to hear at that age. And so I was visualizing finding my passion. Like, there's this big forest and there's rocks everywhere. And under one of the rocks is my passion. Like, my calling is under one of those rocks. And so I was looking all of undergrad. I'm like trying out different internships. I'm, you know, doing coffee chats with different people. And I'm like, nothing is clicking. All these jobs sound pretty cool. I think I'd have a good time doing them. But I'm not finding like my thing that sets my soul on fire. And then I read this book called Designing Your Life by Bill Burnett, which I recommend to everyone I meet. And in that book, he says, screw finding your passion, follow your curiosity. And that was so comforting for me, because I was like, oh, I'm curious about so many things. And that feels like a much easier piece of advice to follow, right? Because that's a lifelong journey. You can keep following your curiosity. And so then I really tried to pay attention to what I pay attention to, what I feel curious about. And that ended up being tech and sociology and social behavior and learning experiences online. So one day I just looked that up. I looked up like PhD tech society, maybe, I think was my first keyword. And Northwestern, of course, pops up. And this perfect program. I remember I journaled the day I found this program, like, oh, now it's terrifying that I know what I want to do, because now what if I get rejected? You know, before I didn't have this North Star I was aiming for. But I applied, I found an amazing advisor. I work with Dr. Agnes Horvat here, and she's phenomenal. And things just kind of clicked. And I still applied to industry jobs, but I told myself, if I get into this program, I'm going, because it felt so fateful. And I'm here now, and I'm very happy about it. I didn't take a break in between undergrad and grad school, but I think that's also a really good option to figure out exactly what you want to study and what you want to research for 5 years, because it is a commitment.
Thank you for that. I have to go back and pick up on something you said earlier, because I find the tension fascinating. If you don't mind going back to the point you made about understanding the content that you're presenting online and sometimes the oversimplification that you give it, and that is palpable to people. And at the same time, developing this rigorous way of thinking in a more nuanced way, and that you're part of your identity is on kind of simplifying and oversimplifying content for people and giving them hope that life is pretty straightforward and simple and do steps 1, 2, 3 and you'll be okay. And then this reality that you're experiencing, which is it's more complicated, it's nuanced, but people don't necessarily want to hear that. Maybe I'm misunderstanding, but I'd love to hear about how you experience that cognitive dissonance and how you resolve that in your head a bit more.
Yeah, isn't it fascinating, right? Because I'm in this PhD program, which is a 5-year program, right? That's like as long form as you can go, the least oversimplification you can go. And online, I'm trying to present something in 30 seconds or less. It was hard. And I think the reason I stopped wasn't even for everyone else. It was for me, because I could feel my own brain chemistry changing. The way I would read something and say, how can I make this sound sexy in 15 seconds? I mean, that is a crazy thing for your brain to start doing. And for a while, I just thought that meant, let me take a break from posting online. And then I said, maybe that's not the answer and the solution here. Maybe the solution is I still post online because people really love to hear what I have to say about things, but I post in a way that feels a little more authentic to me. I post it in a way where I'm not trying to oversimplify this. Instead of making a 15-second video, I'll make a 2-minute video on this topic, and I'll talk about it a little more. It'll get fewer views, and it did. It did cause a dip in viewership, but it felt so much more aligned with reality and more aligned with me. And that was a big thing, because then I felt more proud of my content. I felt really aligned with the content I was putting out. And then it wasn't as scary to go into a room and be like, oh yeah, I posted that video and I stand behind it, because everything in that video is accurate and well presented. And it's maybe not as concise as it could be, but it's as accurate as I could present it. So that's
And let me give you credit. 2 minutes is like wildly short compared to a 2-hour lecture. So listen, you are like, if you can convey a complicated idea in 2 minutes, I think that's one of the things I struggle with and my colleagues struggle with, is that they know too much. They have the curse of expertise that they feel like they can't explain anything complicated in less than 20 minutes. And people with great patience don't have 20 minutes to always fully engage in an idea. So I think you're finding the right medium, somewhere in between. So
yeah, and I always do recommendations, or I'll synthesize an essay and they say, here's where you can go read the entire essay. I do that all the time now, because I want people to have, and I also want to give credit where credit is due. People are really smart and they're curious and they can read, you know, people can read and they're literate. So if I give them the things I'm using to learn and the places I find wisdom, then they can have that too. And maybe that's not, this is not the platform for it, but I like to call myself a curator in that way, where I can give people reading lists. And I have 15-year-olds write to me and say, like, I read this article you recommended and it taught me a lot. And that's always, it blows my mind, because I wasn't reading that stuff at 15. God, no. Like, I was reading Harry Potter for the third time. So it is really nice that the internet is this like really special place if we treat it as such. And if we let it educate us on the right things.
Yeah, I love that. I feel like we often can get cynical about the internet, but also like we have felt a lot of the harms of social media, but finding those pockets of joy online and these really restorative communities, and that you can like connect with 15-year-olds and be a mentor from afar. So I want to bring it back to something you wrote in your bio, which was, I'm most excited about understanding how we exist on and with the internet. I want you to expand on that, especially the on and with, like existing with the internet. I just thought that was an interesting word to connect humans and the internet together.
Yeah. First of all, thank you for reading my bio. I always assume, no, I'm writing stuff into the void, right? Like, I'm like, no one is reading this. So that's really nice. Thank you. I think, isn't that so interesting? As I was a little girl, I remember being like, the internet is so cool. You know, I remember the first time I ever made a Facebook account, like all these things that are so formative for me. And I think we're a very special generation where I remember the world before it. I remember opening up a dictionary to find something. I remember that vaguely. And I also remember creating my first social media account, scrolling through Twitter for the first time with like these wide-eyed. It's just like, it's a really special thing to be at this cusp of like things are happening right now online. And like we said before, I have this TikTok platform where I'm on the internet and then I'm understanding it from a really anthropological perspective. Like right now I'm conducting a study on the dissemination of knowledge online. So like how science articles spread, how scientific knowledge spreads online. So I'm looking at these two different sides of the internet at the same time, almost every single day of my life. And I'm learning that it's infiltrating everything we do. I mean, the other day I went to a lab dinner and I'm sitting in between two people. One person is studying linguistically how the internet is changing us, how these acronyms like LOL and OMG are changing the way we think. That, and then on the other side is a guy who's studying how memes online affect political elections. And I'm like, this is insane, right? And this is my favorite thing about getting a PhD is I get to sit with people like this who are just such fountains of knowledge. And I'm like, the internet is this really fascinating thing that we get to simultaneously be on and be with. And I think of the internet almost as a living, breathing thing. Even if I'm in conversation with another person and they keep checking their phone every 3 seconds, first of all, so annoying, but the internet is in the room with us too. When they're showing me something they're seeing, they're going back to it. It is this thing we are with constantly. I check the weather. I, you know, set my calendar invite before this event. I mean, everything we do is being touched by it. So it's a really fun lens to study through. I really think it's amazing. And I think actually if we're not using it while we study, we're missing out on a huge party right now. So I love the internet. I know we're supposed to be cynical about it, and I am, but I'm also excited about it.
I have so many questions, but I think the question I'm going to ask is the intergenerational experience. So you mentioned remembering looking up a word in the dictionary. I imagine your advisor looked up every word in the dictionary. And their parents maybe had to go to the library to get out a dictionary. So in terms of access to information, I'm curious how you think about your, as you pursue this research, how do you think about your particular experience and how it's going to influence the way that you ask questions and the way you think about the accessibility of information?
Wow, this is amazing. And it makes me think of in around 2010 to 2011, the iPad came out. And my grandma, I call her my nani, she lives in India. And at that time, we would just call her on the phone. And my mom was like, no, we have to go, we have to buy an iPad and take it to her so we can FaceTime her. And so we were like, okay, we'll do that. So we bring her this iPad. And she looks at it and she goes, oh my God, no, I'm going to break this. She closes it, puts it away in the cupboard. She's like, I can't use that. And we're like, no, it's not fine china. You have to use it. And so we teach her how to use it. And so I'm trying to find the word for like double click in Hindi. I'm like, that word doesn't exist, you know, because it's 2011. I don't think it still exists. And so I'm trying to teach her how to use this iPad, and it's hard. And the iPad is amazingly designed, right? Like full of affordances, the idea of a button, the idea of closing the app like this. I mean, it's a phenomenal tool. But it made me think a lot about how when we design something, we're designing it for people that sometimes we can't even think of. And this goes back to the idea of participatory design. And when you're designing for someone, they actually need to be somewhat part of the process. Of course, Steve Jobs said, like, they don't even know what they want yet. And I think there's some value to that, too, of being this brilliant genius and kind of telling the future in tech. But I think of that a lot when I talk to business students and they have, like, have made the solution and they're like, okay, now we're going to go talk to people who are going to use it and get feedback from them. And it's so opposite of the way my brain thinks. So I think for me in my future and in what I design, I want it to be with people and for people and with people in mind. And I think it's really, I don't know if either of you have read the book Invisible Women by Caroline Criado Perez. One of the best books ever, I think, is the reason I'm in the PhD program I'm in, because she's so inspiring. And she talks a lot about, if you don't have a need, it's hard to imagine that need, right? It's hard. It's difficult. And so I hope for myself and in the future of tech and design and social tech as a whole, we get to talk to people and learn what their needs are and design for them. And not just design to optimize, but design to build and be really creative in what we're creating. I think optimization culture right now is peaking, and I hope it goes away soon, because I just don't think it's as innovative and creative as we think it is. So I hope that kind of answers your question. I don't think I've done a lot, or I've done anything at all in my career yet, so I don't have a lot to say there, but I think we have a lot of potential to create really interesting, truly creative things for people.
Okay, so let's fast forward like 50 years. You're looking back on your career. What's the thing that you want to say you did? That's the biggest thing you'll have done, or your impact on the world?
I want to teach. I hope in 50 years I can say I've taught people and people have learned from me and learned with me. And I hope I've been a co-learner for those 50 years.
Well, I mean, you have taught me through TikTok, your podcast. I hope you, teach many more people in the future. One last mentor moment question. You've talked a lot online about being loud about what you love. And I think that can be a scary thing. And sometimes it's how does that manifest at school or outside of school? What does it look like in practice? But I love that piece of advice. So I was wondering if you could expand on that. And how can young students who are maybe a little bit embarrassed or scared to do that feel fully empowered to be loud about what they love?
Yeah, I think fear is such a normal emotion. Like, I'm sure I look at someone like Liz, I'm like, she can never be scared. But then I'm sure you are, you know, but it's so easy to think that's just an emotion happening to you. So I want to validate that for anyone who's feeling that. And then I try to imagine it as I call it Fear Mountain. And I imagine I'm right here and there's a big mountain in front of me. And that's where all of my fear is. That's where I feel, oh my God, I don't know anything. This professor isn't going to like me. I'm not going to get into that conference. They're not going to like my workshop proposal, whatever. That's all in Fear Mountain. Posting online, that's a huge thing, right? People are going to think I'm stupid and cringy and embarrassing for posting online. And then on the other side of Fear Mountain is my dream life, is everything I want, is all my goals and my ambitions. And the person that I think is the person I want to be is on the other side of Fear Mountain. And it's fine if you never want to climb that mountain, but then you're never going to get to the other side. And so it's just a helpful visualization that I always tell myself. I'm like, yeah, it's going to be scary. And then it's going to be over. And then I'm going to have the thing. And even if that thing is a rejection, which I can talk about rejection forever, I think rejection is fine. And it's, a sign that you've tried. And I think the only real failure is just not trying. But everything I want is on the other side of Fear Mountain. And everything you want is probably on the other side of Fear Mountain. And so I think being loud about what you love is just climbing to the top of Fear Mountain and saying, I really want to get into that conference. Or, hey guys, I'm going to start posting online because I really love, I love cooking and I want to show you my recipes, whatever that is. But being loud about what you love lets you meet other people who love what you love or are intrigued by what you love. And it's everything in the world to me.
I love that. I love that you gave it geography, that there's a mountain.
And that's topography,
I think that's beautiful. I think that's really beautiful. So you offered some advice. I'd love to end on this piece of advice that you offered earlier, which was to get curious. So it was really a focus more on process rather than finding the passion. And I'm curious, what would that look like for an undergrad like tomorrow to get curious? Like, what would they actually do to get curious versus taking this like find your passion approach? So what is that? What does it concretely look like for an undergrad to get curious tomorrow?
Yes, I can't wait to answer this because I recently did this activity and made all my friends do this activity. I had like a girls' night and I was like, okay, we're all going to do this now. And we all got out our big journals and we made a little mind map of the things we pay attention to in our lives. And we each had a very different looking map. Like some people used color. Some people did it on a whiteboard because they didn't want to do it in their notebook. Some people used lines to connect different thoughts. I used bubbles. And I just wrote down everything I think about. So like in the middle was like my friends. I think about my friends a lot. I love hanging out with my friends. If I could have one passion in life, it would be to hang out with my friends all the time. And then I did like, I love poetry slams. I started writing everything down. I wrote like, I think about AI literacy a lot. I think about what it would look like to create games about AI literacy. So I like start writing everything I think about, you know, when I wake up in the morning before I'm going to bed at night. And it can be as silly, quote unquote silly, as you want, or it can be as quote unquote as academic as you want, and just get everything out on that piece of paper. And like for me, I had farmers markets on there. Like every Sunday, I'm like, oh, I would love to go to a farmers market right now. You know, so really don't over intellectualize this. And then afterwards, sit down with people you love, sit down alone, and look at which of those things you want to do in the future. I mean, nothing in your life you're going to like doing 100% of the time as a profession. But if you like doing it a lot of the time, and then you have discipline and work ethic and creativity, you can make a really beautiful career out of it. Or your career can be something you do to make money, and your passion and your profession don't have to be intertwined. That's completely okay too. But figure out what you pay attention to and figure out what you're curious about and what you want to learn more about. And I think that's a really good place to start. And then again, be loud about what you love. If you think, you know what, pottery is coming up a lot on my list of interests, let me go enroll in a ceramics class on campus and just see what that brings me. Let me talk to the head of the ceramic studio and just see what that brings me. I think that's really helpful. But you have to be at least trying to meet people, to be talking to people, being curious, reading about it, whatever that means to you. You can't sit in your bed and just watch TV and expect like a little light bulb moment. You have to do a little bit of work, but it's a really good starting point.
Yeah. So everyone get a journal, get the pen that Malvika recommended. Get your friends together and do this. Well, thank you so much for sharing your time and stories with us, Malvika. I feel like that was a great concrete exercise to end on. Like, you know, finish listening to this episode and run and get your journal and try that out and try to get curious tomorrow. So thank you so much again for joining us.
Totally. Thank you for having me. I hope at least one thing I shared struck a chord or did something like that. But thank you both. I just adore you both. So thank you so much.
That was Malvika, and you can find out more about her work in the show notes. And you can learn more about this show by going to technicaldifficultiespodcast.com. Drop us a note at technicaldifficultiesteam@gmail.com or leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. It really helps people discover the show. We're especially curious to know what stories and insights resonated.
This show is produced by Lauren Lin and Liz Gerber and made possible by the Center for Human-Computer Interaction and Design at Northwestern. Thank you so much for listening.